often referred to as the JNF. It's a key agency that's responsible for stealing Palestinian land and for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. The JNF is an integral part of the Zionist regime, but it also has an influential presence in the UK. I'm going to be talking to experts about the JNF's activities after this investigative report by Bianca Rahimi, examining precisely how the Jewish National Fund is engaged in ethnic cleansing.
The Jewish National Fund was a key land-seizing mechanism of the Zionist movement. Founded in 1901, it features heavily in most accounts of ethnic cleansing prior to the Nakba of 1948. However, post-foundation of the temporary entity, it has enjoyed a special status as an untouchable claw of Zionist enterprise. Today, the JNF is an instrument through which Israel is able to deny international accountability. The Jewish National Fund is a parastatal body which manages to wield some of the powers of a state without being restricted by any of the responsibilities of a state, according to international law. It enabled Israel to bypass UN Resolution 194 and block Palestinian right of return by asserting that the land was owned now by the JNF, a supposedly private body which is not subject to international law. It also allows Israel today to keep a quasi-arm's-length relationship with the colonization of Palestinian territories and evade scrutiny. The relationship between the JNF and the temporary entity is clear, with a major overlap of board members between the Israel Land Authority and the JNF.
The JNF is also deeply intertwined with the Israeli military.
Thank you for helping bring all of us together to serve our beloved Israel and the IDF. It is a privilege for Israelis to defend and protect our country. Special Uniform makes it possible for all of us to proudly fulfill our commitment to serve Eretz Israel. With your contribution to Special Uniform through the Jewish National Fund, you've changed their lives, their families' lives, and so many of our special citizens' lives.
JNF UK functions in Britain as a charity, despite its action clearly being incongruent with the requirement of fulfilling a social good. It has well-documented involvement with both illegal settlement building and militarism in Palestine. The UK branch of the JNF supports numerous Israeli military academies. Derech Eretz, Neve Otzem, In Prat or Miofer, Nachson, Mitarim Lachishand and Hashumur Hachadash. These institutions provide military training and act as a gateway directly into the Israeli army. JNF UK was inspected by the UK Charity Commission in 2005. The Charity Commission stated it is not open for the charity to support Israel since this does not itself denote a charitable purpose. The inspection report went on to recommend action in the following way. They should try to ensure that they refrain from indicating moral or political support of Israel, rather explain the focus of their charitable activities.
Former senior vice president of the Board of Deputies, Gary Mond, recently resigned from his position after it came to light he had posted Islamophobic ideas online, notably that civilization was at war with Islam. He was simultaneously the honorary treasurer at the JNF UK and has retained his position there. JNF UK chair and former Israeli intelligence officer, Samuel Hayek, was also found to have made Islamophobic remarks. Other Jewish groups and even Israel lobby group, the Board of Deputies, spoke out against him. On the 13th of January, the UK Charity Commission opened an investigation into the JNF UK to assess the situation.
Obviously, the JNF UK did not stop acting as a settlement-building, militaristic lobby group which promotes a hostile foreign power. It just became further entrenched in British society, adding to its list of patrons former British Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who share their patron status at the JNF UK with the current Prime Minister and President of the apartheid entity.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Fatih Nimer. He's a political scientist, an activist, and he's also a former teaching fellow at the Democracy and Human Rights Programme at Birzeit University. And he's a co-founder of the Decolonize Palestine website, which is well worth checking out. We recorded Fatih's comments earlier. Welcome to the show. Now, I asked Fatih to tell us about the origins of the JNF.
Well, the Jewish National Fund was founded in the very early 1900s as an arm of the Zionist colonization of Palestine. Its main role was to acquire lands and to help with settling as many Jewish settlers, Zionist Jewish settlers in the lands as possible. And to those ends, it basically subsidized the whole colonization of Palestine through those means, because the farmers in those days could not at all subside without direct support from abroad. So its goal was to basically bring this land and put it into Jewish hands. That's their mandate until this very day. And they did a job of purchasing lands, acquiring lands through other means, and keeping them only for Zionist uses.
I also asked him about the JNF role in the Nakba.
The JNF's role during the Nakba was as the entirety of the Zionist entity. At the time, it was all a complicated, basically, network of all of them working together towards the aim of ridding Palestine of as many Palestinians as possible. And after the Zionist forces would destroy a village, for example, the JNF would come in and they would plant trees on top of the villages to completely erase the Palestinians from the area. They would take all of these areas and they would build entire nature parks to erase clusters. And these nature parks would, of course, be planted with European trees, to the point where some of these areas are called like Little Switzerland and other areas, because this is where the Zionists came from. Like, the earlier Zionists were come from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, and they came and they wanted to basically create a European colony in Palestine. So during the Nakba and until this day, the JNF plays a huge role in basically greenwashing and giving a light of legitimacy for the destruction of Palestinian villages and the erasure of Palestinian identity, the erasure of Palestinian, you know, existence in this land. It goes hand in hand with the military, goes hand in hand with all kinds of political and economic decisions, and it plays a very big role with that until this day.
David, I want to come to you then. I mean, the JNF's website says that it collaborates with elite IDF units on projects. I mean, how does it maintain its fluffy veneer?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? This is an organisation which in this country is regarded as being a little bit controversial by some people, but it has a sort of under-the-radar quality. It's an organisation engaged in conspicuous human rights abuses and land theft and ethnic cleansing, and as you say, is collaborating with the IDF. Now, that there should be no place for an organisation like this in the UK. It is a charity. It has charitable functions. It's supposed to perform public benefit. Now, it's not clear to me how collaboration with the IDF could be any sort of public benefit. But nevertheless, it has gone through previous charity commission inquiries and has not been closed down, stretching back many, many years, actually. So there's a real question here for me about why it is that organisations like this are able to carry on in breach of what would appear to be their charitable objectives and functioning as if they're normal charities when they're in no way normal charities. They're engaged in activities in occupied Palestine which breach international law, which breach human rights legislation, and which, for any conscience, any person of conscience, should be completely unacceptable.
Mm. Well, I mean, we also asked Fatih, or just to say Fatih told us about the JNF and how it provides a form of legal protection for the apartheid.
The thing about the Israeli tactics when it comes to its propaganda about how it has, equality for all citizenship is that it has these little technicalities and loopholes, and the JNF participates very willingly in this. For example, when we're talking about, they say all of our citizens are equal, but they don't mention that nationality determines your national rights, and nationalities are not equal in Israel. Similarly, the JNF controls huge areas of land inside the Green Line, and it only allows the use of these lands for Jewish uses. So basically, if you're not Jewish, you're not allowed to use these lands. It's estimated actually that around 80% of all the territory inside the Green Line or inside Israel is off limits if you're not Jewish. You can't lease it, you can't buy it. And this is through like technicalities and loopholes, whereas they say, well, there's no official ban on the purchase of these lands by non-Jewish citizens or so forth. But what happens is that there are these committees, and the JNF has a very important vote on who gets to use land, like state land, and who doesn't get to use state land.
I mean, David, the JNF was investigated by the Charity Commission in 2005, and a few actions were recommended. I mean, can you tell us a bit about that?
So, I mean, one of the things that the Charity Commission recommended to the JNF after it investigated was that it should be wary of seeming to promote Israel, and that instead it should focus on its more charitable objectives, which are to do with land, etc., in Israel. Now, it hasn't done anything noticeable to carry out that requirement, and the Charity Commission has not done anything subsequently. It's very much a pro-Israel charity, and all of its directors and people who've been in directorial roles there, stretching back to 2005, have always been, you know, extreme pro-Israel partisans. So there's a real mismatch here between, you know, the actually sensible thing that the Charity Commission said, which was that they shouldn't be allowed to be promoting Israel, and the actual practice of the JNF, which to its very core is a pro-Israel organisation and continues to promote Israel, and whether it's right or wrong.
Mm. I mean, what involvement does the JNF UK have in so-called anti-racist groups in this country?
Well, the JNF UK is a series of different charities, and they operate under a number of different names. They've got a Scottish branch, etc. And so they do engage in fundraising activities where they bring in pro-Israel personalities, and famously in about 2005 they had Colin Powell, the former US Secretary of State, came to speak to them in Glasgow, and there was a big demonstration outside. Goldie Hawn, the actress, another one who came, and various other people have been to do fundraising for them. And that fundraising has gone off the boil since there have been so many protests about the kinds of things that they do. Their involvement with anti-racist activity, well, it's not quite correct, is it? I mean, they've been involved in racist activity in this country. Two of them only recently involved in Islamophobic statements, asked to step down from various bodies. It really does illustrate the specific Zionist component of Islamophobia in this country. Really, the State of Israel has been promoting this idea that Muslims are particularly Islamophobic since about 1984 or so. I mean, way back in history, one of the very earliest interventions of Benjamin Netanyahu when he was the ambassador to the UN in the US. So they've been promoting this idea that Muslims are particularly Islamophobic. No empirical basis for it, but this shows you the activities with the JNF and the people there making these Islamophobic statements, that there is a specific Zionist component to Islamophobia, which helps to promote Islamophobia more widely on the far right and in other places as well. So the involvement of the JNF in these kind of politics is on the side specifically and only of the racists.
Yeah, I mean, what's this wrong with the campaign against anti-Semitism as well? And I think the chap called Gideon Falter, I mean, they've got some connection there, hasn't there?
Yes, this guy, Gideon Falter, was one of the early people who set up the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, which campaigned, as you'll recall, against the Corbyn-led Labour Party, took a complaint to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission. And Falter is also on the JNF, so there's a connection there.
But also,
if you look very closely, and we've done this, at the accounts of the JNF, you'll see that there are transactions in there, third-party transactions, related party transactions, and that they show that most of the CAA's budget for a couple of years came directly from the JNF. So it's actually funding work which is supposed to be about tackling anti-Semitism, but which is in reality, of course, about tackling those people who would be willing to stand up for Palestinian rights.
Sure. Well, let's just pause there for a moment, though, and have a look at this report on how the JNF uses environmentalism to deflect attention from its racist activities.
The JNF has always worked hand in glove with the Israeli apartheid entity, and today is using environmentalism as a subterfuge for further ethnic cleansing. The director of the JNF's Land and Afforestation Department in 1948, Yosef Weiss, was simultaneously on the transfer committee for the first Israeli government, which oversaw the displacement of almost a million Palestinians. The JNF is hoping to fill Palestine's Mojave Desert with around 800,000 Jewish settlers.
However, this will take many years. So in the meantime, the organization has planted vast forests of 250 million trees.
Israel is planting trees, European trees, that have no connection to the land in the Bedouin land in order to take the land off the Bedouins. Israel is taking Palestinians off their land and putting trees in their place. And it's taking the trees of the Palestinians also. In the village of Al-Araqib that was demolished more than 250 times today, 4,000 trees, olive trees, were taken by the Israelis. The Israelis destroyed them and in order to build a GNF forest. The body that and the organization that is doing crimes against the Bedouin Palestinians in Al-Naqab is called the GNF.
The JNF has brandished the justification of environmentalism, but this falls short when considering that they've used northern European pine trees, which easily catch fire in Palestine's scorching sun. The JNF has planted trees in the names of some of its supporters in the UK, from former Labour MP John Mann to LBC political editor Theo Usherwood. Edgar Davidson nominated trees to be planted in the name of famous British Islamophobes Tommy Robinson and Katie Hopkins for, quote, standing with the Jewish people and for exposing the lies spewed against Israel. Tommy Robinson's legal advisor, Robert Festenstein, is also president of the Zionist Central Council and represents Prestwick Hebrew Congregation on the Board of Deputies. Environmentalism as subterfuge for ethnic cleansing brings together some fascinating bedfellows.
Well, when we spoke to Fatih earlier, we asked him what the JNF's up to in the Naqab Desert right now.
The JNF, as usual, has been a very important part of Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. And the new target for this area is now the Naqab Desert, which they try to, you know, frame as some kind of desolate backwards barrens that has never been taken care of. But actually, data shows that it was one of the most, you know, agriculturally used areas in the area. And as soon as the Palestinian Bedouins were ethnically cleansed from there, it stopped producing anything. So now they have these little oases that they, you know, tried to show, look, Israelis made the desert bloom, but they actually made everything worse. So what they're doing right now, they're trying to say, oh, we're having these tree planting campaigns supported by the JNF, which they try to put forward as an ultimate good. Who could, you know, oppose planting trees? But the thing is, they're not planting trees for the sake of the environment. They're planting trees to take over more and more land, annexing more and more lands from the, you know, the indigenous Palestinian tribes that have always lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they're taking over the land little by little, and they want to put them in these small little contained cities that they're building for them, away from their ancestral, you know, feeding grounds and all that. And the JNF is playing a leading role in that. They're the ones planting the trees. They're the ones planning parks to do over there. These are not kind of neutral activities. All of these things are aimed to replace the indigenous population. This also happened in Turtle Island in North America. A lot of the natural reserves in the United States were created with the purpose to remove the indigenous tribes living there and the indigenous nations. It's settler colonialism learns from each other. And this is basically a kind of tactic that all settler colonies have been using. And the JNF is an expert at this point in it.
David, I've come to you now. I mean, what's the involvement of British celebrities and media figures in this tree planting nonsense?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? People who are, especially people who've been at the forefront of the so-called campaign against anti-Semitism in this country, in the UK, over the last 5 to 7 years, who have said that what they're doing is nothing to do with Israel, it's only to do with protecting Jews who are subject to racial hatred and all that kind of thing, which, I mean, most of which, of course, they've made up. But nevertheless, let's take that at face value. But when you look at this tree planting thing, you see they come out from underneath their defence of, we're only targeting anti-Semitism, to see that they're actually paid-up supporters of ethnic cleansing and indeed of racism, the racism and ethnic cleansing of the JNF. So there are people in there whose names are listed there who have been central to the campaign against the Corbyn-led Labour Party, for example, and there are also celebrities. I noticed the actor Eddie Marson's in there, and it was J.K. Rowling. The author is in there, and these are people who are not just there to defend Jews against anti-Semitism, as perhaps they sometimes say. They're also there to defend the ethnic cleansing and the racism of the JNF.
Yes, and sort of engaged in propagandising. Well, look, I mean, we also asked Fatih about what he made of the JNF's claims about environmentalism.
Once again, there's no actual environmental message in what the JNF does. It plays a big part in their propaganda that they're making the desert green. They're trying to, you know, dry all the swamps and all that. But what has actually led to? It's led to ecological disasters. All of these trees that they plant, because at the end of the day, the Zionist leadership in origin were Central and Eastern Europeans, and they want Central and Eastern European trees. And this is the kind of trees that they brought with them. They grow these trees, and they're surprised every few years when there's a giant fire that, you know, burns down half the country inside there, because they want to live in Switzerland in the Middle East. And that's just not how, you know, the environment works.
David, I understand that the JNF UK is also currently under investigation by the Charity Commission for Islamophobia. I mean, can you give our viewers the benefit of a bit more background information about that?
So, yes, there were two incidents at the end of 2021 and the beginning of 2022. One, the guy in charge of the JNF, a guy called Samuel Hayek, who's not British, by the way, he's Israeli, and he's lived in Britain for some decades. He's a former Israeli military intelligence officer, in case you didn't know. And he made some statements which were widely criticised, including by some liberal Zionist groups, as being Islamophobic, and was forced to step down. And then... Quite soon thereafter, another person who was on the JNF's board and who's also on the board of deputies, a guy called Gary Mond, some of his Islamophobic posts were revealed, and he was called on to step down from the board, and I think did, but hasn't stepped down from the JNF. But nevertheless, as a result of these two quite serious allegations of Islamophobia against these people in the JNF, the Charity Commission is currently investigating. Now, whether the Charity Commission will come up with anything sensible, whether there will be anything sensible at all in its report, remains to be seen. I wouldn't hold my breath about that, because the Charity Commission has shown that it's quite keen not to properly investigate Zionist charities, whereas it is very keen to investigate Muslim charities and to try and have them shut down. Indeed, there's a whole history going back to 9/11 of the Charity Commission investigating Muslim charities, quite a number of them, at the behest directly of the State of Israel. So you can see there's an imbalance there. But if they were to take a proper approach to this, they were to properly investigate the JNF, what you would find is that there's a breach of charitable objectives, and that much of the activities carried out by the JNF, and indeed many other Zionist charities, are way beyond what they say they're doing in their charitable objectives. And they're, of course, supporting illegal settlements, ethnic cleansing, and the theft of land in Palestine. And they should have no place as charities in this country. So I hope that a properly constituted Charity Commission investigation would find that kind of thing.
I mean, and just say a little bit more as well about the campaign against the JNF, particularly in Scotland, because I think there's quite an active campaign going on there, isn't there?
So, yes, I mean, Stop the JNF is an international campaign, but there have been chapters of it in various different countries, and Scotland's been particularly active. I mean, there was for 25 years an annual JNF Scotland golf competition.
Yes, indeed, right? I'm familiar with that, yeah.
Which the Scottish Palestine Solidarity people who were involved in Stop the JNF went along and tramped around the Glasgow golf course on the outskirts of Glasgow and had it stopped, and it's not going on anymore. And also, of course, they used to have these fundraising dinners in the centre of Glasgow in a plush hotel right beside the M8 motorway, and that's where Colin Powell was demonstrated against, and indeed, Goldie Hawn and others. And these have been much more difficult to put on now that more and more people are coming to realise what the JNF is about and how it's involved with ethnic cleansing.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed for that. Fortunately, we're out of time. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now. Thanks indeed. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Fake news about Kim Jong-un gets wall-to-wall coverage, but citizens of a key U.S. ally opposing a joint military exercise goes largely unnoticed, says Tim Sharrock, author, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Media Ignored Major Anti-U.S. Military Protest in South Korea. Stay tuned for more. In America these days, almost any information about North Korea, be it rumor, fake news, or just plain silly, becomes fodder for the mainstream media. From TMZ to The Guardian, reporters know there is an insatiable appetite for anything that puts Kim and his country in a bad or crazy light. But when it comes to South Korea, which hosts 28,500 American ground troops, and the Pentagon's largest military base outside of North America, U.S. media coverage is, shall we say, highly selective. That was made resoundingly clear on August 14th, when Seoul was the scene for the largest public demonstration in decades against the U.S. military presence in South Korea. Amazingly, not a word about the protest appeared in the U.S. media. That day, thousands of people chanting, "This land is not a U.S. war base," demonstrated against Ulchi Freedom Shield, the first large-scale military exercises between U.S. and South Korean forces since 2017. The protests were organized by the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, KCTU, South Korea's second-largest labor federation. They were joined by a range of progressive allies, including People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy, PSPD, an influential citizens group founded in 1994. At a time when military tensions on the Korean Peninsula are escalating and there is no clue for inter-Korean dialogue, we are concerned that an aggressive larger-scale military exercise will exacerbate the situation, PSPD declared, adding, "We once again urge the U.S. and ROK governments to suspend the ROK-U.S. joint military exercise and make efforts to create conditions for dialogue." At the demonstration, protesters took direct aim at the heart of U.S. policy in Korea with signs that read, "No war rehearsal, no U.S. and no Korea-U.S.-Japan military cooperation." Outside of the Korean press, the only outlets to cover this massive showing against militarism were Iran's Press TV and China's CGTN, which provided extensive video of the mobilization. The single print story on the march appeared in Xinhua, China's daily wire service. Neither the New York Times or the Washington Post, which often set the pace for U.S. press coverage of Asia, deemed the demonstration newsworthy. Hypocrisy, yes. As we put in a sardonic tweet, every rumor, fake news, intelligence leak, or eyebrow twitch about Kim Jong-un and North Korea gets star treatment in the U.S. media. Yet, when thousands of South Koreans march in Seoul against U.S. ROK war games, not one peep. The contrast seemed to hit a nerve. By the weekend, nearly 6,000 Twitter users had liked the post and over 2,000 had retweeted it. The contradictions were evident on Twitter itself, as it often does with countries we are not supposed to think it slapped a label on one of the posts about the demonstration urging users to stay informed because this tweet links to a media website. With that warning, Twitter was effectively delegitimizing the coverage of demonstration. To be fair, political rallies on the left and right are a common occurrence in South Korea. Obviously, editors and reporters must make choices about what to cover. But in a country where a majority of its citizens support the presence of U.S. forces and a U.S. general has operational control over their army in times of war, a rally of several thousand citizens openly calling for a U.S. troop withdrawal is certainly newsworthy. At the same time, the drills have been a hot topic for years. In 2018, with much of Washington opposed, they were downgraded to computerized simulations as a way to build trust. During the denuclearization talks between President Donald Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, those talks collapsed in 2019 primarily over Trump's refusal to lift U.S. sanctions in return for a partial shutdown of the North's nuclear infrastructure. This year, with North Korea regularly testing its long-range missiles, the new presidents in Washington and Seoul, Joe Biden and Yoon Suk-yeol, decided to resume the real-life exercises. The air, land, and sea drills, which in the past have mobilized around 50,000 South Korean and 17,500 U.S. troops, began on August 22nd and wound up on September 1st. Sadly, the discrepancies in coverage reflect old patterns going back to the early days of the Cold War. Editorial staffs of major U.S. newspapers and cable news shows and now Twitter's upstart crew are steeped in Cold War mythologies about the Korean War and largely reflect the viewpoint of Washington's national security community. Currently, both parties see in the North a determined and dangerous long-term foe, and in the South, a reluctant ally torn between loyalty to the United States regime and its expansive economic ties with China, America's new nemesis. In this world, there is little room for coverage of South Korean trade unionists, leftists, and progressives who stand against the American consensus. That mindset was recently on display at the Post when it praised South Koreans for electing Yoon, an inexperienced conservative hawk who said during his campaign that he might consider a preemptive strike on North Korea to protect peace on the peninsula. South Korea makes a welcome turn toward the U.S. just when it is really needed. The headline crowed. The Post editorial also took a nasty swipe at former President Moon Jae-in, parroting right-wing talking points that he had consciously played down North Korea's human rights record and balked at adding new batteries to the American THAAD missile deployment that has drawn Beijing's ire. For America's papers of record, the failure to cover South Korea's progressive left also reflects a failure of nerve. The KCTU and People's Solidarity that organized this month's anti-war demonstration have deep roots in the democratic movement of the late 1980s, when years of struggle culminated in the massive demonstrations of 1987 that forced the pro-U.S. generals who had ruled the South for 26 years to step aside. During that era, both the Times and the Post offered extensive and often outstanding coverage of dissidents and government repression. But in the recent years, they have been far more interested in covering North Korean defectors and warning the public repeatedly about a possible underground nuclear test than exploring the complex internal politics of South Korea. Ironically, these papers are better prepared now to cover Korea than any time in the past 40 years. Since 2020, they have built large bureaus in South Korea and relocated their Asian news hubs from Hong Kong to Seoul, giving them an opportunity for first-class coverage of perhaps the most dynamic country in Asia. Stephen Dunbar Johnson, the Times International president, recently told the Korea Joongang Daily, "Looking at a 5, 10, 20-year horizon, Seoul just feels like it's right in the middle of the action. But in this coverage, the opinions and views of all Koreans need to be heard. That is particularly true when dealing with an issue as critical as the U.S.-Korean alliance, which President Biden has called a linchpin of peace, stability, and prosperity, but many Koreans now view as a barrier to their country's future."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami, dini wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about some of the rules of miscellaneous nature according to the jurisprudence of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islam Gloss on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker, as always in the studio. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about some of the rules of miscellaneous nature. For example, the first question that I would like to ask you, in the wedding parties or the like, is it, Sheikh Javid, permissible for women to wear transparent or tight clothes that show the contours of their bodies, the women's bodies, and other types of dresses that show most parts of their bodies, such as a screen net or something like that, you know?
You're right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If it is a female-only gathering or a women's-only gathering, of course, it's permissible for women to wear transparent or see-through clothes that show their bodies and, of course, revealing clothes that, you know, as long as there's no one to, no non-mahram to see them. And as long as this kind of dress does not lead or does not entail any kind of, you know, evil or any kind of facade or corruption, you know, that's very important because wearing such clothes in and of itself is permissible. And if it's in a female-only gathering, again, it's permissible, provided that it does not lead to any mafsada or any kind of evil.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a devout woman to wear glittering black shoes?
Well, wearing black shoes, a lot of people ask about wearing black shoes. First of all, this is a matter of confusion. Wearing black shoes in and of itself is permissible, you know, black shoes. But when it comes to wearing shoes that are glittering, whether black or white or anything, okay, if these shoes are flashy and eye-catching and they are, you know, kind of attractive, you know, women should not wear them in public in places where, you know, men might get attracted to them, you know. So because of the mafsada or the consequences that it does, that wearing such shoes does have, women should not wear such shoes in public in places where men are there.
You know, Sheikh Javid, in some countries, it looks like when you go there and see and visit those countries, you see that the black color is more popular, it looks like, actually.
Yes.
All right. But in some other countries, as you mentioned, in some of the previous programs, as I can recollect and remember. For example, India is not like this, the subcontinent, right? So they wear flowery and different colorful. Kind of color or colorful, in fact, cloths.
Sure.
But I just would like to ask you this question, you know, about the black colors, you know, for clothing. Is it really obligatory or incumbent on the Muslim women to wear black colors only for their clothes, such as headscarves, trousers, pants, dresses, whatever?
There's no such mandatory rule regarding wearing clothes. You know, the Sharia, Islamic Sharia, does not prescribe black colors for clothes. In fact, the contrary could be correct, to the effect that, you know, the Islamic Sharia wants us to wear white and, you know, happy, you know, colors which are, you know, white, which are, you know, which keep a person, you know, happy and, you know, kind of can affect his spirituality. Now, as far as wearing full black, it is, in fact, reprehensible. It is kind of makruh,
right,
to wear full black, especially when you are praying. Mm-hmm. When you are offering prayer, whether it does not make any difference whether you are, it is for men or women, wearing full black is discouraged. Mm-hmm. It is makruh to wear full,
yes,
black while praying, while doing any other religious activities. So it's better to avoid wearing full black. And it's not true to say that it's incumbent for women to wear black scarf, black, you know, shoes, black clothing, you know.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the miscellaneous jurisprudential rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And, well, Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question in this part of our program. Is it permissible for a woman to wear a kind of hijab or a veil that, you know, trigger the other people's attention and unleash their desire? For example, we can say wear the veil or the chador in an unconventional way, or for example choose or use socks, for example, with a screaming collar, let's say, all right, or yes, a material which unleash the desire.
Well, it's not permissible for a woman to wear such unconventional dresses or wear such clothing or your chador or veil, whatever you call it, in an unconventional way, because when you wear something which could be very normal in some other countries, but it's abnormal, which it is kind of unconventional in another country, women should not wear such clothing or such, you know, wear such hijab. It's not considered to be hijab when it is attractive, when it unleashes desire, and when it, you know, when it's deemed flashy and attractive. So in every and under all circumstances, it is necessary for a woman to wear a cloth which is modest and which does not attract attention.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javid, is it also permissible to trade in, to make, to buy, to sell transparent stockings?
It is, of course, permissible to wear such clothing and to sell, to buy, and to engage in trading or such things. Mm-hmm. And it's not restricted to stockings. Of course, a man can trade and can buy anything, women's clothes, women's shoes, and women's garments, men can export and import things by, and of course, carry out transactions, and the transactions are valid. The money which is generated, the income that's received through selling and through the sale proceeds, mm-hmm. Of course, is halal for man, and there would be no objection to such a person.
And the last question, Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for unmarried men to work in boutiques selling women's clothes and cosmetics, provided that, of course, they abide by their religious and ethical rules and norms?
If that is the condition, because one of the main concerns is that men might end up falling into a sin with women, because they interact with ladies, with girls who come to buy cosmetics and, of course, anything like that. So men are very much prone, and they are very much exposed to different things interacting with ladies. Of course, if that's not the case, and as you rightly mentioned, if men observe the rules of hijab, the rules, the ethical norms, and abide by the religious principles and commandments, of course, there's no objection in selling these things and working in boutiques and things like in places like that. But this is very difficult, and it's necessary if one feared that the man might end up falling into a sin, he should not engage in such activities.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers and elaboration of the jurisprudential rules of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, my dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Muqtada al-Sadr is calling for an immediate end to bloodshed. He asks his followers to leave the green zone after 2 days of deadly unrest. The West Bank city of Nablus becomes the scene of fresh violence as the Israeli military raids a Palestinian home. Ukraine says it's targeting Russian positions in Kherson with heavy strikes. Moscow reports fresh Ukrainian shelling of a nuclear plant it's holding.